and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. Have you both received the written list of our procedures?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions? On that basis, we're ready to proceed with argument in Gurley v. Torres.
Good afternoon, members of the court. I'm William Ballas, representing the appellant. In 1997, several Pueblo doctors created the Southwest Healthcare System, and this system, which was fairly complex, consisted of Southwest Healthcare Physicians PC, a primary care professional corporation, Southwest Healthcare Physicians IPA Inc., which consisted of primary care doctors and specialists, the Southwest Healthcare Partners LLC, which was made up of the PC and the IPA, and it was the management arm, as well as the Southwest Healthcare Facilities LLC, which consisted of 50% ownership by the PC and 50% ownership by Albert Gurley. Rita Torres, who was a high school graduate, was hired to be manager of the Southwest Healthcare System by the physicians. In 1997, after this system was formed, a medical facility at 431 Quincy, Pueblo, Colorado, was acquired for over $1 million. Under the terms of the agreement, the PC was to pay for the mortgage, the upkeep, taxes, and insurance. Mr. Gurley was not to make payments, but he had strong financial backing, so he was a part of this investment. In 2000, because of doctors leaving the PC as well as a declining patient base, they catered primarily to Medicaid and low-income clients. They were not able to make the payments. Mr. Gurley instituted several lawsuits, not only against the PC, but the IPA and other individuals. He tried to evict them from the facility. That failed. Subsequently, an agreement was reached on December 31, 2001, wherein Mr. Gurley would pay $80,000 to the PC, and he would become owner of the facility. There was also part of the agreement that if he sold that within 2 years under certain circumstances, he would pay up to a maximum of an additional $120,000. Under the terms of that agreement, the PC was to leave within 90 days. The PC did not leave within 90 days, primarily because they were having trouble constructing an x-ray facility at the new location. After the move, Mr. Gurley instituted arbitration proceedings, and after evidence was presented, he was awarded $33,225 on October 31, 2002. He turned that into a district court judgment on March 31, 2003. All of the shareholders in the PC had resigned by November of 2002. It was discovered in 2001 and early 2002 that two of the shareholders that were remaining were J-1 visa holders and therefore could not be shareholders of the company, and therefore they just simply submitted their resignation and left. That left basically nobody to run the PC. Rita Torres consulted with Doug Pearsall, an attorney who had been advising her for several years, and there was no discussion about dissolving the PC, but instead a way to keep the practice going, because there were more than 2,000 Medicaid patients and 5,000 to 6,000 other patients. A new system, Southwest Medical Center Inc., was created, and they contracted with physicians to provide services. Albert Gurley never attempted to execute on his judgment, never took any deposition of the doctors. He concentrated on Rita Torres and Molly Torson, and in August of 2005 instituted a lawsuit against Southwest Medical Center Inc. as well as Rita Torres and Molly Thorson. The plaintiff and Rita Torres asked for jury trials. There were four claims for relief, and the case was ultimately scheduled for trial March the 11th of 2008. On March the 5th of 2008, after we had gone through trial call in February 22, and a trial management order was entered, Albert Gurley, through his counsel, asked that the case be tried to the court and not to the jury, and Judge Mattoon granted that the next day, except as to the issue of a fiduciary responsibility violation. During the commencement of the trial, Mr. Grulet first called a reader to read Rita Torres's deposition that had been taken in the past. Then he later called Rita Torres and tried to compare the two depositions. With regard to one of the physicians, Dr. Lorenzo, his deposition was taken. It was not until the second day of the trial that it was discovered he was going to use his deposition instead of being personally being there because he was 100 miles away. That had not been indicated prior to that time. Then following the plaintiff's case, Albert Grulet asked that a fourth claim for relief, successor in interest, be added, and that was granted. At the conclusion of the defendant's case and oral and the arguments, Judge Mattoon then entered a judgment in favor of Albert Grulet and against all of the named defendants on three claims for relief: the piercing the corporate veil, fraudulent transfer of assets, and successor in interest. Albert Grulet then dismissed his violation of fiduciary responsibility claim, and the jury was sent home. There was never any kind of written findings, conclusion, etc., but there was, as the record shows, approximately 30 minutes from Judge Mattoon explaining the basis for her decision. I'm appealing this decision for several reasons. First of all, I believe the court made an error by doing away with the jury trial when everybody had agreed it would be a jury trial until 5 days before the trial was to commence. Also, by adding the successor in interest, I believe that was error because Rita Torres, a high school graduate, could not possibly have been a successor to a professional medical corporation. The medical professional corporation statute specifically sets forth how such a corporation is created. And when a person who is a shareholder resigns or is found not to be eligible, there's supposed to be a procedure in which that person steps aside and is replaced, or the corporation deals with it. That was never done in this case. These two shareholders who subsequently determined not to be eligible just simply resigned and walked away from it. And there's no way that Rita Torres can be a successor to a medical professional corporation.
Let's assume, for purposes of discussion, that we affirm the trial court on the two equitable claims. Wouldn't that moot any error on allowing the successor in interest claim, because the remedies are the same?
That's probably true. But the concern, of course, is that I think there has to be a distinction on what is the basis, and trying to understand the basis for the court's decision is not clear. As I pointed out in my briefs, she was very confused about these statutes. She did not clearly explain how piercing the corporate veil was determined. So I think it's important to clarify that decision.
Is it required? Is there any law that requires that?
Yes, I believe the Rule 52 does specifically state it has to be set forth separately, the findings, facts, and conclusions for each particular claim.
Are you saying that she didn't do that here?
Yes, I'm saying that basically she did not go to each claim and point out the facts and then the conclusion. She essentially kind of made a hodgepodge of everything that went on during the trial and then concluded that there was a violation of the judgment should enter on all three claims by or in favor of the plaintiff and against the defendants.
So is your argument that her order does not contain sufficient findings, or that it's disorganized and not easy to follow?
No, I'm saying it doesn't contain sufficient findings and conclusions to warrant the decision that was made. And that was the other thing. Mr. Kochel was supposed to, as I understood it, prepare a written order, and he just prepared the judgment order, and that made it even more difficult to understand the basis for the decision. Now, with regard to piercing the corporate veil, Rita Torres was not a shareholder in any of these defendant corporations, and I believe you have to be a shareholder. Now, even arguendo, we say that you don't have to be a shareholder to pierce the corporate veil, anybody can be held liable who's associated with the. Nonetheless, she relied on attorneys, accountants, medical consultants to try to understand this mess that she basically was left with. Nobody from these doctor groups ever stepped in to try to help resolve these problems.
Counsel, let me ask you this, though. I mean, what is your legal authority that she would have to be a shareholder? And then how far does it extend? Who other than shareholders, if she doesn't have to be, could
well,
be held liable?
I believe the Colorado statute that allows shareholders to be held liable specifically uses the phrase shareholders. And basically, the whole purpose of piercing the corporate veil is so that creditors of the corporation can hold people who have ownership rights in the corporation liable for individual debts. Rita Torres had no financial interest in any of these, and therefore she had no financial interest which would justify her being liable to a creditor of the corporation.
Can a PC have a successor in interest that is not a PC?
I would say no, that the statute is very clear on who can be part of a medical professional PC. Now,
I'm not asking about a part of the PC. I'm saying there's a PC, and the PC wants to transfer its right title and interest to whatever it has to an LLC. Is it prohibited from doing that?
No, as long as the LLC meets the requirements for a medical professional LLC.
What if they just want to do it to a non-professional? What if they want to do it to Rita Torres individually?
I would say no, you can't do that. Basically, the statute specifically says that when a shareholder resigns, they have to deal with that shareholder either by replacement of the shareholder or other methods.
Thank you.
Okay, and then finally, I don't believe transfer of assets fraudulently was not applicable. Rita Torres was never a debtor of Albert Brulé. Basically, there was an effort to try to make assumption of liabilities in this Southwest Medical Centering Corporation equal to what was being transferred accounts receivable and assets based on book value. And the assets were reasonable, and the accountant in his testimony said there was nothing fraudulent about it. And besides, they were being used not for gain, but for trying to provide services to all these medical patients. So I believe that was error to decide in favor of that. And then finally, with regard to post-trial matters, I believe that it was there to assess interest from the date that the arbitration award was entered. It should have been at the minimum from the time of the lawsuit in August of 2005. And then finally, I believe that the costs were not warranted. There's supposed to be a cost for two depositions. Mr. Crozier was awarded all of the depositions, and I believe the expert, also the mediation fee and the travel expenses for Mr. Crozier. Thank you very much.
James Crozier on behalf of Mr. Gourlet. I think this is a harmless error case. This is a classic case where, we want to use the phrase, as a matter of law, the court has to exercise its equitable powers in behalf of Mr. Gourlet and against Ms. Thorson and Ms. Avalos. The undisputed facts, not going to the court's findings and her findings of facts and conclusions at the end of the trial, that she found Ms. Avalos' testimony incredible, but the undisputed facts through documentary evidence prepared by the defendants, answers to interrogatories, answers to requests for admission, and admissions in the trial management order were that Molly Thorson and Rhea Avalos were insiders, as that term is defined in the Fraudulent Conveyance Act and in other statutes, of Southwest Healthcare Physicians. They had the authority to contract, to hire people. They had control of the bank account. When all of the officers, directors, and shareholders of that entity left the entity, they chose to continue to operate it. They hired physicians to come in and provide medical care to the patients in the names of non-existent entities. They contracted for a lease with another doctor on a facility in the name of a non-existent entity. As part of that lease, they transferred the assets, even though Southwest Healthcare Physicians was insolvent, and that was undisputed. They transferred those assets over to that doctor as part of the leasehold interest, as part of the down payment. Substantial assets, which had, according to Molly Thurston, no financial basis for that. They cost more than they generated in income. They entered into that lease. When Mr. Gourlay commenced an arbitration, they showed up at the arbitration and hired the lawyer to represent Southwest Healthcare Physicians. When the arbitration award was entered, they then, in December, chose to transfer the assets of physicians to Southwest Medical Centers, Inc. They represented both sides of the transaction, undisputed. There is no document for the transaction, no corporate resolutions from any entity, no minutes of meetings, no bills of sale, other than a single-page document. After that transfer occurred, they determined that Southwest Medical Centers, Inc. had never been legally incorporated. They then filed articles of incorporation naming themselves as directors, but they never capitalized the business. They never put a penny of their own money into the business. They not only didn't issue stock, they didn't authorize stock. They never conducted an organizational meeting. They never passed bylaws. They never signed resolutions retroactively approving this transaction. And in fact, even though they continued under that name to operate a medical facility for 2.5 years after 2003, they never filed a corporate tax return with the federal government or the state of Colorado. And according to Molly Thorson, the comptroller, that's because they'd have rather filed no return than filed a false return. All of this was to the detriment of Al Gourlay, who was a creditor of physicians at the time these transactions occurred, whose property he could have went after were transferred to First Medical Centers, Inc., and also to Dr. Snyder. So we believe that as a matter of law, the trial court was correct, and the trial court did make findings. In fact, Judge Mattoon said, defendants simply walked away from one entity and formed a new entity and didn't put any money in it of their own. It was a shell corporation. It was simply a continuation of the former PC, except for the fact that it didn't owe money to Al Gourlay. That's what they did, and that's what they accomplished, and they ran the new facility for 2.5 years. Now, I'm going to address just a couple of other issues. First, with regard to no written order, we believe if you look at the transcript of the trial, the judge did not order me, at least it's not reflected in the transcript, to prepare a written order. And in fact, if you look at Mr. Ballas's brief in this case, in at least two sections of his brief, he discusses the fact that Judge Mattoon had findings of fact and conclusions of law. He never mentions that I was ordered to prepare a written order. Absent an order or a request by Mr. Ballas in writing that I prepare a written order, the obligation of this court is simply to look at the evidence and Judge Mattoon's written, articulated findings and see if it supports her decision. There is a minute order that was entered, but thanks to the days of electronic filing, if you look carefully at that minute order, you will see it was never transmitted to either Mr. Ballas or myself. The minute order apparently was discovered after I raised the fact in my brief that you had to have, without a order, I did not have to prepare a written order. Even if this court were to determine that a written order was in order, the appropriate remedy is to remand this to find that the evidence clearly supports the trial court's decision and remand the matter back to the trial court for a written order. With regard to the waiver of the jury trial, number one, the claims that went Judge Mattoon decided this case on were equitable claims, which should be tried to the court. She left the legal claim to be tried to the jury. With regard to the issue of the trial that I filed at the last minute a request for to waive the jury trial, that's clearly not the case. The record will reflect that at the trial management conference, I indicated that we were considering filing that motion. At that time, neither Judge Mattoon nor the defendants objected. We subsequently did file that motion, and then there was an objection from Mr. Ballas on behalf of Rita Torres. Ms. Thorson, who originally wanted a jury trial, waived the jury trial, and the other defendants had never asked for the jury trial. With regard to depositions, first of all, the depositions of Mrs. Torres are evidence and clearly admissible in our case in chief. She's a party opponent. She was asked questions relevant to the case, and pursuant to the rule pertaining to depositions, we're entitled to use her deposition for any purpose. We read her deposition into the record, where the trial court, by the way, found a professional reader was in order because she said, I don't know, I don't remember, I can't recall, something like 200 times in the period of an hour and a half deposition. So some sense had to be made of it. And then she was called again to be asked certain questions. With regard to the depositions of Dr. Lorenzo, I would just refer the court to the trial management order in this case. First of all, we submitted to the court a list of, I think, 15 days beforehand, or almost 3 weeks before the trial, pursuant to the court's order. We submitted a list of witnesses, and we indicated that Ms. Thorson and Dr. Lorenzo, as well as Ms. Avalos, who's also Ms. Torres, may be called either in person and or by way of deposition. We subsequently, 2 weeks prior to the trial, and pursuant to the trial management order, submitted the specific excerpts of the particular depositions we were going to read. So it was no surprise on the date of trial that we read those excerpts that we notified the defendant weeks in advance of that we were going to read.
Did the defendant ever object before the trial court to either the reading of her deposition or the reading of Dr. Lorenzo's deposition?
The defendant did not object to the reading of Ms. Torres's. They did object to the reading of Dr. Lorenzo's. And an argument was made that that he resided and worked more than 100 miles from the district court in Pueblo, which would put him within the exception of the rule. But even without Dr. Lorenzo's testimony, the undisputed evidence, including stipulations, justified the trial court's verdict. And I would ask you, if in doubt, to look at the trial management order, which has certain stipulated facts which clearly support a claim for fraudulent conveyance and or alter ego. And with regard to the court's question about where you have to be in the hierarchy, that the alter ego or those kinds of transactions equitably would apply to you, I think it's if you're an insider. And Thorson and Avalos were clearly insiders. They had control of the bank accounts. They chose to keep the businesses operating. They had the ability to contract. There's no doubt by all testimony that they were insiders.
Let me ask you this. Is there any legal authority to support your position that all you have to be is an insider?
No, not specific case law. My authority would be that under equity, we're there to prevent a unjust situation. And when we start looking at transactions, for example, in the fraudulent conveyance action, it applies not only to officers, directors, and shareholders, but to, quote, insiders of the business, people with special knowledge and power. And they had that. They were calling the shots after basically Dr. Lorenzo in April, I think it was, prior to the arbitration, said, I resign as an officer, director, and shareholder. I'm going to continue to be an employee until November. With regard to the last two issues, interest, we believe that interest is appropriate from the date of the fraudulent conveyance because the whole, not fraudulent conveyance, from the date of the arbitration, because they are, in essence, the successors in interest. They, in fact, showed up at the arbitration. Nobody from the doctors, they picked who was going to be at the arbitration. They chose to contest the arbitration. And what they did then is transfer the assets, including, by the way, hundreds of thousands of dollars that went through the checking account, and those documents were admitted into evidence, between the period of time of the arbitrator's award and the time that Mr. Gourlay reduced his judgment to his arbitration award to a judgment. Mr. Gourlay had an old-fashioned feeling when asked on the witness stand why he waited so long to do that. He said, I expected them to pay me. That's what I would do if the arbitrator entered an award against me, and that's what I did in the past when an award was entered against me. I wrote a check. Finally, with regard to the cost issue, there was a hearing on costs, and the court trimmed some of our costs and allowed some of the costs. There is no record of the hearing on the costs, and therefore I think that issue has been waived.
I believe I have 1 minute and 45 seconds.
Correct.
I would dispute Mr. Crossrell's assertion about equity. If equity were to prevail in this particular case, he should have brought in doctors. He should have done something against the PC. The doctors got $80,000, and if that had been sold in 2 years, they were going to get another $120,000. That's why Mr. Gourlay didn't move forward. Why would he have to worry about $33,000 when he might have to pay $120,000? I did object to the reading. Mrs. Torres before the reader started, and I was overruled. With regard to the values of those assets, there was no rebuttal by Mr. Crossrell that Southwest Medical Center didn't pay $180,000 in liabilities in return for receiving accounts receivable and those assets. And if you look at those assets could only be used in a medical type of situation, but they weren't used for the gain of Rita Torres. They were used to help patient care. They were used to provide services. And this was not an effort to make a profit or to basically make a lot of money for themselves. There was no wrongdoing by Rita Torres in this particular case, and that was never proved. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Mr. Ballas, I will note for you that Colorado Appellate Rule 28K requires that for each of your contentions on appeal, you must state whether the issue has been preserved, direct us to the place in the record where an objection was made preserving the issue, and make a statement as to what you believe the standard of review is. You've not done that in this case. I would urge you next time to do that. I would also note that it really does help for making a brief that is much more understandable by the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. The court will issue a